Let me begin by thanking the collaborators, a couple of whom are in the audience. Student Binchuan Wan has done some of the work I'll show you about today, and Noam Bernstein. And I want to, in the spirit of the announcement I made this morning, I want to sort of list a couple of the questions, the big questions that I think will come up throughout the rest of the day in the workshop. It's clear from what Jim was talking about that where surfaces contact is key, and also how the friction is produced at those contacts. He talked about some rate and state models for the form of that friction force, and I want to focus more on the mechanisms that produce that friction force and its variation with age and sliding velocity. Try to understand how the total, which is a product of the surface area and the force within the area, depends upon velocity, age, etc. Some of the other big issues that I think we might be discussing over the meeting are, what do we mean by contact? If we're talking about contact at an earthquake fault, we may have things that are miles in diameter, and there may be 30 meters of junk in the middle, and we still consider the plates contacting even though they're separated by 30 meters of junk. It may seem that that's very different than what we find in a car in ball bearing, but in fact, typically there, you have very complex stuff in between the surfaces with many different layers, with many different contributions to friction. So this complex interface between the contacting solids, I think, happens at all different length scales. These mechanisms that produce the friction in contact, is there something that's universal at different scales? Does gouge in an earthquake fault somehow lead to locking of plates in much the way that atoms in Jacob's surface force apparatus lead to locking between two mica surfaces? Or is there no fundamental analogy? How does fracture look at the different length scales? Is there some length of the fault, as we just heard, where things qualitatively change, or can we use similar models at all the different length scales? And then even if there's not the same stuff happening on different scales, I think that there's issues about whether we can learn something from small scales that helps us motivate models for the larger scales that people at the geoscale say are interested in. Or from my point of view, it would also be nice whether we can figure out how a larger scale test can really tell us whether our theory was right or not. You know, can we use large scale observations to help us understand the microscopic? So those are some of the big questions. And let me just now move on to, I'm going to start at the largest scale and then talk about the atomistic measurements. We've already seen this picture. Amundsen's has been mentioned in the past. He didn't actually write the equation J. That was, I think, done by Euler later on. And he used apparently the term mu. But he said that these things were true, that the friction went like the load and was independent of the area. But I want you to keep in mind that Amundsen's was not using dry surfaces because he couldn't get good results. He coated them with pork fat. So these were not dry surfaces, and the laws we learn really have to do with what happens with solids with junk in between them as opposed to dry surfaces. Also, although we haven't seen it so much, all of you know that you can have friction at zero load. Anytime you put a piece of tape on a piece of paper, it does not slide, even though there's nothing pushing down on it. And this is why geckos can climb walls and things like that. There is friction at zero load in most cases when there is adhesion. And another thing you've heard a lot in the previous talk that's not in these simple laws is there's history dependence in friction. Now, the idea of friction proportional to load was originally explained by this simple geometrical argument. People said, well, we know surfaces are rough, as we've seen today, and we imagine that somehow these rough surfaces magically interlock. And then if we want to have one slide over the other, we have to lift it up the ramp formed by the bottom surface, and the lateral force will just be the normal force times the tangent of theta. That gives us a coefficient of friction that's constant and is somewhere between zero and infinity, and we've explained all experimental data. And so this is a very nice model. The problem is that if you do things that change the roughness of the surface or don't change it and just change the surface chemistry, you find the friction changes and it doesn't agree with the ideas of the simple model that somehow the slope of the surface should determine the magnitude of the friction force. But the bigger problem here is that it has nothing to say about kinetic friction, because once we were to lift up over this peak, we would slide back down, the force would be in the opposite direction, and the average force is identically zero in this model. So when we think about friction, the two big things that strike me are, the first thing is, we've somehow got, in static friction, surfaces locking together so that they resist sliding. And any two surfaces we place in contact somehow manage to lock in this way and resist sliding, no matter where we put them. And they resist sliding forward, and then they resist going back to where we started, which is hard to understand from this type of picture. And then this locking, which determines static friction, is very different from the energy dissipation that is related in kinetic friction, the fact that going back to the same place, somehow energy has been lost. And it's not apparent, and in many models, kinetic friction and static friction are very different. It's not obvious why they should follow similar trends, which is what's observed in experiments. So, as I said, this idea that rough surfaces would magically interlock in this way is naive, and of course it doesn't work out that way. Jim has already shown you some pictures of contact between rough surfaces, and many rough surfaces, at least over some range of length scales, can be defined as described as self-affine fractals, and this is seen in measurements at very large length scales and also very small length scales that Krim and others have done. And what a self-affine surface is if you move along laterally by some little distance L, then the height change scales as a power of L, which is less than 1. And this Hurst exponent sort of characterizes the surface. This may seem strange to some, but basically, if you just think of a time-ordered random walk where you go up or down at every step, then you know that the height change would scale as the square root of the distance moved, so that's a surface with a roughness exponent of a half. And this is a little picture of such a surface, and we can place that on the bottom of a finite element calculation with either elastic or plastic elements, and see what happens as we push the surfaces together, where the contacts occur. And it turns out for the elastic case, this is equivalent to having two rough surfaces. The plastic case is more complicated. I could show you some of that, but I'm going to focus on this geometry given the limited time. What does the contact look like when we do this? As Jim showed in the previous talk, in general, if there's no adhesion, which is an important qualification, no adhesion, we find that the area of the contact rises linearly with the applied load. That means that the ratio of load to area, which is the mean pressure in the contact, is constant. And just to illustrate that, I've plotted for a plastic and elastic solid with the same self-affine surface, unfortunately, 1 over this pressure, that is the area divided by the load, and normalized by the modulus of the material as a function of the fraction of the area in contact. And typically, the things that Jim was looking at were way down in this end. So you, in the very small percentage of area in contact, you have a constant pressure. If you get up towards full contact, eventually the pressure must rise. And the plastic actually extends over a much larger regime, which was sort of surprising. It's nonlinear and yet acts more linear than the elastic. So how can we understand these mean pressures? In the case of the elastic problem, there's only one thing with the right units to give us this mean pressure, and that's the modulus of the material. So this ratio must be some dimensionless number, and the only dimensionless number characterizing the surface morphology is the mean slope, the RMS slope of the surface. And so this ratio must be proportional to the roughness, because rougher should give us bigger pressures, with some number. And Bo Pearson, and earlier Bush et al., motivated by the Greenwood and Williamson approach, have calculated this number looking at statistical properties of surfaces, and they get values that basically bound the numbers we find over a wide range of roughness exponents and other parameters. So about 2, basically, is this number. So this very complex surface has this very simple net result for the scaling of the area with contact. Now, in the plastic case, as Jim just said, the usual assumption is that the pressure here in the plastic case is just the single asperity hardness, which is about 3 times the yield stress. That turns out not really to work in detail. So these are simulations showing the variation in this mean pressure as we vary the yield stress. And of course, in the limit of extremely large yield stress, we get the elastic limit, where the answer depends upon the surface slope. You begin to see plastic effects at pressures that are only about half the yield stress, which is a sixth of the single asperity hardness. And the reason for that is that the complex structure of the contacts that I'll show you in a moment lead to a very wide distribution of local pressures. So some of the contacts have much higher pressures than others, and they yield before. And the distribution is characterized by an exponential tail in this elastic limit and gives us this early onset of the plastic behavior. And then if you look out in this regime, you seem to see some sort of power law scaling of the mean pressure with the yield stress rather than a simple proportionality. You may get in the extremely weak limit, and here we're looking at yield stress over modulus, below 10 to the minus 4, you may get something like 6 times the yield stress, which coincidentally comes out of an analytic two-dimensional calculation by Gao and Bauer from Brown. But in the range of real materials, which is in here, you get this power law scaling, and you can get values that are easily a factor of 2 or 3 smaller than the single asperity hardness, or larger, depending upon this ratio of the yield stress to the elastic modulus. And that would be interesting to check in your data to try to do the correlation with the fluctuations about the line with this prediction of this calculation. -10 to -1 for P over E prime? The mean pressure in the contact. The mean pressure was up to 1/10? Wow. In order to get to some of these higher numbers, in principle, this scaling continues up here, but it depends upon the value of the RMS roughness that we use. Okay? So if I were to use a rougher elastic surface, then I could get up into this regime. Okay? So the exact crossover behavior is not clean. One can get into higher limits. But this general result of this crossover and the fact that you're not seeing the simple result is robust, okay? And certainly for most things that I know of, you're probably more in this regime. Okay. Now, why can you get to strengths bigger than the single asperity? It's because when you have a single asperity, you've got nothing pushing in from the two sides, okay? So your yield is characterized by the difference between the downward pressure and the confining pressure from the sides. What if you have other asperities around? Now you have two over here pushing down, they push this way, and that makes it harder for yield to occur here. Okay? And so it's the interaction between asperities that give us this and give us larger values of the mean pressure. And this is what the morphology of the interface looks like. You saw some images again from Jim, and you see this great complexity of structure. He and others have tried to look at contact with a very simple model that I'll talk about first, where you just take the solids as rigid, move them towards each other, and wherever they would interpenetrate, you say, there we have contact. Okay? I'm going to call that the overlap model, and this shows what the contact looks like for this surface with that model. If you use an elastic or plastic model for the same surface, same fraction of the area in contact, you get entirely different contact morphologies, even though the area is the same. Okay? And the difference is here, this asperity does not interact with any other asperities. But here, when I push down on this asperity, it pushes down the surrounding asperities, making them less likely to contact and spreading contact throughout the region as opposed to localizing it near the highest peaks. And plastic contacts give you something intermediate between those two cases. If you look at the details of the distribution, you find very, very small up to very, very big contacts characterized by a power law distribution, which Jim has also seen. And the exponent of this power law is very different in these different cases, leading to qualitative differences, like here having most of the area in the big contacts and here most of the area in the small contacts. So this is a qualitative difference. And the fractal dimension of these little contacts is also very different in these different cases. And all of this affects the interactions between the asperities and the overall mean pressure within the contact. Now, this fat power law tells us that almost all of the contacts are very, very small. They're down at the lower length scale cutoff of the model, giving us this sort of singular problem. And I also showed you in the elastic limit that what was important was the mean slope at the smallest length scales. So somehow our entire physics of the contact area is dominated by the smallest length scales, and since we're using a continuum model, we might wonder whether it's self-consistent, depending upon whether the self-affine scaling goes all the way down to, say, the atomic sizes. And I think that's one of the big problems that still is out there for experimentalists and others. What is the small scale cutoff, and how should we, because we need it in order to regularize the solutions. And one of the things that Binchuan and I have been doing recently is saying, well, if we have all these very small contacts, when can we continue to use continuum theory? People use Hertz and JKR theory to analyze atomic force microscope tips and other things with 30 nanometer diameters. I guess we heard about that for 100 nanometer diameters yesterday. Does this make sense? And I think everyone knows that there's one limitation of continuum theory, is this idea that you can treat the displacements here as a continuous strain field and use bulk elastic constants. But there's another key assumption that's not often stated, which is that the surface is smooth and differentiable at the smallest length scales of the problem. How do you make a tip out of atoms that looks like that? The answer is you can't. And we find that while this assumption works down to surprisingly small length scales, this intrinsic atomic scale roughness leads to some dramatic deviations that can easily extend into the 30 to hundreds of nanometer length scale for the radius of curvature of your contact. And just to illustrate that, this shows the pressure distribution under a nominally spherical tip. All these tips have the same radius. They differ at the atomic scale in how you've tried to approximate a sphere. Here you've bent a crystal to make a sphere. Here you've just cut a sphere out of a crystalline or an amorphous material, and the distribution of surface pressures that you see without and with adhesion are very different. This actually looks very much like the continuum theory, but I challenge you, except in Jacob's experiment, to find this as a typical thing. I think if you buy an AFM tip, it will be more like this. Okay? And it turns out that this has effects not just on the surface stress, but it can change the yield stress by factors of two, the friction by orders of magnitude, and the details really do matter of the atomic structure. So, having talked a little bit about contact and the area of contact, I now want to look at how people have thought about what happens within the contacts, how we get the surfaces locking together, what mechanisms seem to work and what don't. And I've already mentioned that there's this idea of geometrical interlocking, and that that doesn't work just because two surfaces brought into contact are unlikely to have the right sort of structure to mesh in a natural way. Now, you might hope that, say that, well, even though when I bring them into contact they don't start out matching, that somehow they can deform elastically and lock together through small deformations. People have looked a lot at this scenario using simple models of, say, crystal on top of crystal. And so here you see crystals with two different lattice constants, and that's the generic case. And usually these would be an irrational ratio, so you would have what's called incommensurate surfaces. And looking at this type of model and simpler idealizations that are amenable to analytic analysis, you find that you can get elastic deformations locking the surfaces together and giving you static friction and kinetic friction that's comparable. The problem is you need to have the interfacial interactions strong compared to the internal interactions, and that's generically unlikely, partly because surfaces tend to be chemically passivated, and if in fact you do have these very large interactions, things would want to intermix. So it's just not a likely scenario, is the conclusion. And we'll hear about some work related to this from Jackie Krim later this afternoon, who finds that if you look at either fluid or incommensurate crystalline layers on a substrate, you get sliding with no static friction, but rather a force proportional to the velocity. And somewhat more surprisingly, the friction goes down when you get a crystal instead of a fluid. And there's some modeling that can be done to explain that. But this has also been seen for more conventional systems, including mica on mica, molybdenum disulfide, graphite, layered materials where you vary the angle between the surfaces to make them incommensurate, and you see static friction going away. There's also some simulations that have found this, where if you say take copper on copper, you can get friction and wear only if the surfaces are aligned. If you redo the simulation with, say, 111 copper on 100, you don't get static friction unless you have a tip that's just a few atoms across. So there's a lot of work indicating that this doesn't happen. Another common mechanism that was referred to by Jay yesterday is the idea of welding. You bring two surfaces into contact and somehow they become one. And if you take two pieces of copper or two pieces of plexiglass, as we heard yesterday, the idea is somehow diffusion causes things to intermingle and eventually you don't even know where the fracture was. I think that that may well happen, and it's an important issue for us to be thinking about if we're talking about gouge and minerals depositing between the particles. I'll just say that if you try to do it in simulations, you don't see it because the time scales are too large. And so most of the atomistic work has avoided this. There's some evidence that in many cases, it's limited to cases of high surface reactivity or extremely long times. Bowden and Tabor talked about plastic deformation and plowing as an important contribution to friction. And there's been some studies of that. In terms of explaining why we get a coefficient of friction that's some material property, this is problematic because it turns out the friction that we get from this mechanism depends upon things like the magnitude of the load and roughness. We wouldn't get the same mu for different experiments. And to illustrate that, this is some work by Jim Belak, who was looking at a hard tip on a substrate, and he increased the normal force and measured the cutting or frictional force, and he basically got no friction until the load was big enough to produce damage, plastic damage. And then he got a huge friction. So you would get a coefficient of friction that would transition between effectively zero and a large number, and that may in fact be important in machining processes and things, but it's not, you know, our classic mu of copper is 0.25 or whatever. This is some recent simulations that Binchuan, Judith Harrison, and I have been doing, where we look at self-affine, we look at amorphous solids with self-affine surfaces. This is the surface. And we measure the force of friction versus the normal load. And you see you get a nice linearity that you can describe by a coefficient of friction. But the coefficient of frictions you get are proportional to the RMS roughness of the surface, which is not typically what you would like for a robust coefficient of friction. Now, if you had something like that, you'd have to understand why you always ended up with the same roughness after sliding. And it's sort of interesting. It turns out that you can directly relate, in this case, the friction is directly proportional to the rate of plastic deformation in the substrate. And so here, we've got colored. The red atoms are ones that are plastically displaced. There was supposed to be a movie that started up showing you this gradually evolving with time, but it didn't happen. Maybe we can see it later. But it's interesting that plasticity is clearly important in these results. So this is an interesting mechanism, and it may be very important in gouge and deformation of gouge. Something I haven't mentioned, and I think Bo will talk about, is there's also, for kinetic friction, dissipation due to viscoelastic and plastic deformation far from the interface due to the stress release, which can also be a means of dissipating energy. But what I want to focus on in the remaining of time that I've got is what happens if we've got not two surfaces, but surfaces with junk in the middle, whether it's gouge, wear debris, any of the things that are observed in real contacts, down to the very simplest case that I'll consider, which is just individual molecules that are relatively easy to move, that are not strongly bound together compared to the binding in the solids. And it's easy to see that generically, for any two surfaces, if you have such weakly bound material, it can get shoved around or move around thermally, and it will find places where there's room for it in a free volume sense, or where its energy is minimized in an atomistic sense. And once it finds these local minima given the two surfaces, it will resist any displacement, because statistically anything you do is now going to make these unhappy. Okay? So this always gives you friction, explaining one of the mysteries that I mentioned at the start of the talk. And it turns out it also gives you kinetic friction comparable to static friction, explaining the second. And there's very clean evidence this happens in the surface force apparatus, where you see a glassy forming in between the surfaces. I think you can argue it's also been seen in granular media experiments. So suppose something like this is going on. Let's focus in here. So let's assume we have a glassy material in these contacts. So the total friction will be the area of actual contact times this yield strength of this glassy material. And quite generally, for glassy material, one finds that the yield stress rises linearly with pressure. And that's something that Jorg showed in his talk on Tuesday for amorphous glasses. But it's seen in experiments and many other places. And if we just plug that in, then we get a term in the friction which is proportional to the real area of contact, and another one that's just proportional to the load, because the pressure times the area gives us the total load. So we can understand Amundsen's law in cases where the real area of contact is small, which is typical in the adhesive limit, where it's proportional to the load, in which case it just you have just this mean pressure, which is contact with a constant, which I showed you. And you can also understand why, in many cases, when the load is zero, you still get friction. for something like tape or many elastomeric materials. And in fact, it turns out that Coulomb used this form rather than ignoring this term to fit experimental data. So this is not new that one needs to go beyond force proportional to load. And it turns out that if you look, as I'm going to show you, at either the amorphous glasses Jörg talked about or at these molecular glasses between surfaces, just a few molecular layers, you get this behavior. Not only that, this alpha, fortunately, doesn't depend upon things that an experimentalist doesn't control. So the way we've looked at that is using very simple MD simulations. Where we have a crystalline surface. We've also done rough amorphous surfaces, but I won't have time to talk about that. And we put in the middle either spherical atoms interacting with this classic Leonard-Jones potential, or we bind them together to make small chains. We don't make them too long. We're not talking about polymers. We're talking about sort of simple short chain molecules that might come from airborne contaminants. And we can now slide, keeping a constant pressure, and measure the static and kinetic friction and see how it depends upon things that an experimentalist typically wouldn't control, like the crystallographic axis of this plane compared to the plane below, the sliding direction relative to crystalline axes, how much junk and exactly what junk is between the surfaces. And it turns out other things you might expect to matter, like how strong the interaction is between the wall and the stuff in the middle versus the internal interactions, or how big things are compared to each other. So just to illustrate some of this surprising insensitivity to things, I'm going to show you four different wall geometries we've looked at. This one's clearly special. Here you have identical aligned surfaces. All the red are effectively over the black atoms. And it's clear if you try to slide these can lock together. You get this classic geometrical interlocking. This is different. These other cases, these are obtained by rotating the top surface by some angle, and you get moiré patterns, and you can see that you have atoms at all different positions relative to the substrate. And with nothing in the middle, you get no static friction effectively for these cases. Here, I haven't rotated, I've just changed the spacing by a little bit. And all of these give us very, very small static friction with nothing in the middle, you know, effectively zero. And this one gives you a big effect. When you put stuff between, all three of these, B through D, give you effectively the same result for the shear stress as a function of pressure. And this slope, which would be alpha, is the dominant thing determining our coefficient of friction. And so it doesn't depend upon those details within a 10 or 20% level that's a typical experimental variation. Only this very special, unique case of exactly the same surface, exactly aligned, gives you something different. And this linearity extends up to pressures above the gigapascal range. We've gone up to about 10 times what I'm showing you here, and you still see this linearity, although you might expect subsurface damage at those pressures. I don't have time to show you a lot of other straight lines, but you can see in the papers that this slope is fairly independent of how much stuff, going from a 16th of a monolayer up to two monolayers of stuff between the surfaces, the chain length varying from spheres to chains of length 6, and much more surprisingly to us initially, this is the sort of thing you tell the student to go back and do it again, was we changed the strength of the interaction between the wall and the stuff in the middle by a factor of 2, and we effectively got no change in the friction force. And then we changed the geometry and we got a big change. So if we make the spacing between the walls bigger, 1.2 up to 1.5, we get more friction. If we make the size of the stuff in the middle bigger compared to the spacing in the walls, we get a very small friction. And it turns out you can understand all these results and even the values of these slopes and the insensitivity to these factors from a very simple hard sphere picture that would also work, say, in a granular sense. Here's the idea. We have high enough pressures So we don't need to worry about the attractive tails of the potential. And the force pushing down on the surfaces has to be supported by the repulsive interactions between the particles. This force is going to be, on average, the pressure in the contact divided by the number per unit area of things of atoms that are carrying the pressure. Okay, that's where the coverage comes in. And the force for a Lennard-Jones potential just scales as the 13th power of the radius. And what that means is that the radius, the sort of separation between atoms during sliding, is going to scale in this way. And so everything like coverage, pressure, and even this energy of interaction enters to the 13th, the 13th root, okay? And so it's irrelevant, okay? And so you just get a fixed size. And that's really all that matters. We can think of these like hard spheres. And if we have hard spheres, and we want to try to slide them over each other, their size matters. If their one is very small, then it can get deep down inside the others, and it's going to be hard to pull it back out. If it's very big, then it can't go so deep inside, and it will be easier. And now we can go back to this geometrical interlocking idea, where now this geometrical interlocking is produced by these molecules getting pushed around, but now they need to slide. And the slope of this surface of closest approach gives you alpha. It gives you the... I'm into my questions already. Uh-oh, I was expecting a five-minute warning. Sorry. Anyway.
That was 5 minutes ago.
So, anyway, you can understand this, and since I've just been told that I've used up my time, you can also go now and look at kinetic friction, and it turns out that you find you still get this linear dependence on pressure, but now with a log rate dependence in this alpha, much like the log rate dependence that Jorg showed you for amorphous metals earlier in the week. And so to connect to this rate state model, this term was associated with the change in the friction per unit area within the contacts, okay? And we now have a mechanism that gives us this logarithmic rate dependence or velocity dependence of that internal term. It doesn't address the aging of the contact area. You'd need to go to some other approach to get that. But these numbers, in terms of the size relative to mu naught, these were fairly small, flat systems, are not so out of range with experiments. And again, they can be motivated by the Eyring model that you've heard about before. Basically, the slower you go, the more time there is for the molecules to diffuse and lower the frictional barrier. And I don't have any time to talk about stick slip, which you'll hear in a minute, and I'll stop there.
Okay, well, Mark has left lots of time for questions.
There's a whole coffee break.
Thank you. I noticed, Mark, in your discussion of the materials in between, the third body or whatever, in general, in the examples you showed, you were producing rather low friction coefficients. I guess if we look, sorry to take the parochial view of the rocks, but there are so many of them. It looked like you were typically in the range of 0.05, 0.2, you know, like that. And is there anything that you could change that would let you get up to numbers like 0.6 to 0.9 by such a process?
Sure. I'm having trouble finding the transparencies, but I'll just say it. It turns out that all of these are done for, that I showed you, were done for atomically flat crystals with junk in the middle, okay? And there in the surface force apparatus experiments and some work with molybdenum disulfide, you do find these very small values of the friction. If you go and you take an amorphous surface with some small scale roughness, these numbers go way up. You can go up to the 0.3, 0.5, I think, maybe the sort of range that we've typically seen in those cases. And they they were also somewhat limited in how when the real roughness spectrum. So I think that's the key feature that gives you those larger values.
Mark, it's hard not to see the analogies with fault gouge, of course, because you're showing a lot of the same geometric effects that we reproduce, assuming elastic particles, but they're pretty stiff.
Temperature?
And so, the first observation was basically what you just covered, that what you're describing here are essentially smooth surfaces. There's a limit to the interlocking that can occur. And then as you put coarser particles in there, then they cannot get locked into the interstices between these atoms themselves. So that does change the friction. I guess my question guides towards what's happening between the particles or atoms that actually represent that junk. Because there you still do have atomic interactions which must influence the overall frictional behavior of that material regardless of the roughness of the surface that are bounding them.
So you mean in this case, why don't the interactions matter? Is that the...
Yeah, so how important are the interactions between the particles within the junk?
Okay.
Throwing away the roughness effects, which are also geometric.
Mm-hmm. So the key features here are if you have some rapidly increasing repulsion, so that it looks more or less hard spherule-like, and you're at high loads, then the interactions don't matter very much. If you go to the zero load limit, if you go to very small loads, then the adhesive interactions begin to become important, and then you do see deviations from the line. But I've focused in all this on the very high pressure limit, where this initial sort of van der Waals bonding in these models is very small. If I had the ability for the stuff in the middle to form covalent bonds that were more comparable in strength to the material that was bounding it, then that sort of initial offset, that tau naught, would rise to much, much larger values. And that may in fact be happening in something like gouge that's aged to the point where there's been mineralization, okay? But this was originally thought of in terms of the surface force apparatus experiments, where that kind of strong covalent rebonding isn't occurring. But I think there's a number of different ways one can generalize it, depending upon the specific case that one's trying to look at.
Mark, if you have very rough surfaces, does the what's the influence of the junk? Does it go away?
No, the junk is still very 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 important for rough surfaces. Now, yep. Again, I have to be careful, because if I have really really sharp peaks, okay, that can scratch away the junk. And there's some nice experiments that my wife Patty McWiggin did. And I think similar things people have seen with AFM tips. You scrape away the surface layers, and it doesn't matter what your lubricant is because you don't measure anything. She then looked with 40 micron spheres, and then again with surface force apparatus. And at the 40 micron sphere level, you begin to be trapping the stuff in between the surfaces. And so even though there's some large local roughness, you see an effect of the lubricant. So at some point, you know, you may be able to squeeze lubricant out, and in other regions not. I mean, Bo has thought a lot about squeeze out of lubricant layers as well. Well, I'm sorry. Lubricants, yeah, all molecules produce static friction, and lubricants produce smaller static friction than others. I guess Paul has...
Just a comment. If you take diamond as an example, there the friction can become 0.01. So the question is, if you have lubricant in between or contamination or whatever you want, you could not explain that you would get much higher friction. So maybe in that case you will squeeze out everything because you have extremely high pressure in the
You're talking about some of the experiments with the diamond-like carbon films where
No, just pure diamond. When the surface is passivated. If you do use diamond in ultra-high vacuum where the surface is not passivated, you have a huge friction. But when the surface is covered by hydrogen or something like that, hydrogen atoms, you get extremely low friction, like a hundredth of 0.01. And so that you could not explain assuming that there is some pinning lubricant in between
the surface. Right, but I and so for example, there's some experimental work by Erwin Singer and Kathy Wall where they've looked at that, and that very low sliding friction, at least in the work I'm aware of, only occurs under steady sliding at high velocities where there's reason to believe that you can keep on pushing out the material. If they slide more slowly so that stuff is able to accumulate within the contact as the contact moves, they see the friction go up. If they do waiting time experiments, they see the friction go up. So yeah, I agree that there may be cases where one is getting rid of the stuff in the middle because it's so weakly bound because of the passivation of the surface layer, as in this case. There's also some MOS2 experiments that indicate something like that might go on.
Oh, Mark, there's a guy named Donald Buckley from Lewis, NASA Lewis in Cleveland, who about 20 and 30 years ago did massive experiments on crystals, single crystals, and found large changes with changes in direction and orientation. And I just wonder, if, one, if you didn't know about, I can give you a reference. And secondly, it might be very appropriate to this work.
I get with the Andy Gelman has also done some more recent things where crystallographic axes and subsurface plasticity seems to be affected by that. But I'm not sure I know all of this.
I'll give you the reference.